Okay, so bedside view. I'm afraid I'm very much a jobbing doctor. This is going to be very much about practical things that are happening within palliative medicine and some of the things I come across in my own practice. Okay, so in terms of the end of life agenda, which I'm sure you've all heard of, when is end of life? Now, the GMC, bless them, have helped us out on this one. Don't bother with the bottom bit. It's all common sense and it's just kind of words. But the key thing, and this sort of goes along with practice, is that end of life is when a patient is likely to die within the next 12 months. So that's the kind of time frame. And it's interesting that Lord Falconer has picked up on that for his latest bill. Probably going by the fact that the GMC have now defined end of life. But when is end of life? Now, it used to be very much that end of life happened, as I think John said in his first talk, when doctors had run out of things to do. So what you got active treatment, active treatment, active treatment, active treatment. And then when the patient was chain stoking, they realized, oops, it's not working. And the palliative care team were called for kind of the last 4 or 5 hours. Now, thankfully, newer models are a little bit more understanding, and palliative care services now try to integrate very much with active treatment. And enlightened doctors realize, I think, that there is a period whilst active treatment is going on, but where symptom control and starting to think about end of life needs to happen. And that's sort of what this is meant to represent. You get the two running in parallel, more and more and more. And then you reach a stage where it's recognized that the patient is dying, you need to start planning. And then you get the very dying bit, and then it goes into bereavement. So that's a much more realistic model of how services now try to work. Where does end of life care happen? Well, let's be honest. Lots of juniors think, patient's dying, send them to the hospice. But there are simply not enough resources in the hospice movement. The bulk of dying patients spend most of their last year in the community. Okay, so this is the bread and butter of good GPs, district nurses, modern matrons. Having said that, where do people actually die? And this slide always shocks people in management and people in the PCTs. People would like to die at home, if not at home, in a hospice. What actually happens is people are dying in huge numbers in hospitals. Very, very few get to a hospice. This is 5 years old now, but those figures haven't changed hugely. If there has been a change, it's been around these proportions here. And again, there's huge regional variation. But although they don't want to die in hospital, that is where most people are dying. And along with that goes all the problems of it being medicalized, of it becoming actually very hard to do good end-of-life care because you go to hospital to get better. Problem with that approach is that you only get one chance to get somebody's dying right. You can't mess it up, change the treatment, and go back and have another go, like choosing the wrong antibiotic. You know, if you're lucky, you get another chance to try the right one. And the memories for the people that are left behind go on for years. Many of the people who've been very influential in the cause for legalizing euthanasia feel so strongly about it because they look back to an appalling death. And we spoil the people's lives for years if they experience a bad death. It's really important that we try to do our very best so there are not bad memories that spoil things for the generations to follow. This is an example of what I'm talking about. This was a lady with breast cancer who was treated and treated and treated. Till the bitter end, largely because of the emotions of everybody involved, nobody was able to step back and be objective about this lady's care and say it's time to do things differently. And her husband said all the care she received before meant nothing because she died the way she did. They were so keen to get on top of the cancer. She didn't have good symptom control. She had chemotherapy that made her really ill. She didn't have time. She spent it in hospital. She was separated from the people she loved. That's what stayed with him. He didn't remember the conscientious house officer who'd done the great history. He didn't remember the brilliant radiotherapist. It all went out of the window because she had a horrible death. So it's really important we try to make it better. And it is about choices, and it's very much about unfinished business. We need to be able to recognise dying, and not just recognise it, but talk about it with people. The simple reason most people get bad end-of-life care is because doctors don't recognise it, can't recognise it, and then they're too afraid to talk about it. I would say very strongly we owe it to our patients to recognise dying and to talk about it. Because if we don't, all this stuff goes out of the window. There's very good evidence that people make different choices if they understand that they've got a short time to live. About where they die, where they're cared for, how they use their time, all the unfinished business that John talked about, saying thank you, sorry, goodbye, I love you, making plans for your children, leaving things behind, leaving things in order. Families say to us, but they couldn't stand it, doctor, they couldn't stand it. Well, actually, sometimes the uncertainty, knowing deep down that things aren't going well but nobody's squaring with you, that's actually far harder, far a bigger burden than knowing the truth. We very seldom find people turn their face to the wall. Occasionally, sometimes it comes as a huge relief that someone's been honest. And also, if somebody is dying, sooner or later, it will be clear to everybody. If we have deceived them, we are in no position then to maintain that relationship of trust. And they will die badly because they will be isolated. Who can they trust if even their doctors and their family pretended that this wasn't happening? So it's really important that we know how to recognise and discuss dying. So this is really a little bit of what I'm going to talk about. I will go into some of the things about how you recognise dying. It is possible. It is a clinical diagnosis, and there are things we can look for. Then how to plan, then something about what constitutes good clinical care, a bit about the relatives, because the Daily Mail has done a fantastic job in confusing people on that one and causing potentially huge harm. And then a tiny bit about the psychological and spiritual care, but that's probably something we can pick up more in discussion later. So, recognising dying. If you only take away two things on this, I want them to be these two phrases, okay? It's about pattern recognition, and it's about rate of change, okay? Get those in your brains. That's like any other diagnosis. You're looking for pattern. You're looking for rate of change. There are several sources of good information about this. One of the best is the Gold Standards Framework website. The Gold Standards Framework, I'll talk about it later, was produced for general practice to help manage patients in the last year of life. And if you put prognostic indicators into the search box on their website, you will get a list of general features and then disease-specific triggers, things to look for in patients with heart failure, COPD, motor neurone, dementia, that will just alert you to things to be aware of for the patient. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about this. Would I be surprised if? Is this patient at risk of? Which is a very interesting way of sort of clarifying your thinking. So, general predictive features. Be on the lookout for things like this. Weight loss. General physical decline. Again, the rate of change. What's happened to mobility? Conscious level, oral intake. That's pretty much nearer the end. Is this patient getting more dependent? Somebody who's been in bed for 3 months is very likely to be dying, if that fits with the rest of the picture. Increasing symptoms and complications of disease, things like hypercalcemia in malignancy, things like developing a pressure sore in dementia or becoming unable to swallow, repeated unplanned or crisis intervention admissions. Clearly someone who is struggling more and more to manage at home, bouncing into hospital repeatedly. Sentinel events. These are interesting. These may not be medical. That could be something like falling over and breaking a hip. It could be bereavement. They've lost their partner. It could be move into a nursing home. Just things that destabilise somebody. Bereavement's an interesting one. Until the 60s, you used to be able to write broken heart on a death certificate as a cause of death. You can't do it anymore, but to some people, particularly some elderly men, I really think they die of a broken heart, and it contributes to their own demise. And then one hard fact, serum albumin, less than 25. Our hospital reporting system enables you to put all the results together and draw a graph. I always get the juniors to look at albumin. And again, as part of the picture, see what's happened. And normally, about 4 or 5 months, 3 or 4 months, before somebody becomes terminally ill, the albumin just drops, and it just keeps dropping. Quite a useful one, again, with all the others. These are the disease-specific ones for COPD. I could put others up there for other illnesses. And again, it's not rocket science, but they all indicate that this person is getting sicker, their disease is progressing. I'll not leave those there. And then finally, you've thought about general things, you've thought about specific things for their disease. Would I be surprised if this patient died in the next year, in the next month, this weekend? I say to the juniors, it's Thursday afternoon. Would you be surprised if this patient died this weekend? And they say, well, no, not really. I said, right, what are you going to do about it? You know, who are you going to tell? What are you going to prescribe? What are you going to say to them? Would you be surprised? And actually, that's as good as the other things independently, the other ways of assessing. And it's all about clinical experience, isn't it? And our intuition. And again, perhaps unconsciously adding the pattern recognition and the rate of change. Surgeons don't like, would I be surprised? It's too touchy-feely. They go for this. Is this patient at risk of dying? So I say that one to them. Yeah. And if you think the patient is dying, the key is plan ahead. Don't sit there smugly thinking everything is all right. Plan ahead. Okay. I borrowed this off Kerry Thomas, who did the GOLD framework. But, you know, it's great. Okay, they could be dying. Yes, but what then? Just take a little bit of time to think, you know, what we're going to do. Don't just leave it to chance. The most important thing, if you think your patient is dying, and again, or could be in that group, let's go back a bit from immediately dying. If you think your patient could be in that end-of-life group with probably less than 12 months, how do you raise it? Should you raise it? Well, I would say yes. We have a responsibility to raise it. How can you? The National Council for Palliative Care found that when doctors initiated a conversation about dying or the possibility of dying, 90% of patients chose to continue it, which is amazing. Those people would not have started that conversation themselves, but they were really pleased when their doctors did. There is a very good DVD called How Long Have I Got, Doc? That is produced by the National Council for Palliative Care. It's aimed at GPs, and it's about how to address this issue. How do I help my patient to understand that they are dying? And it can be done in small groups, and I thoroughly recommend that. It's not cheap, it's about £35, I think. But for practice to work through, it'd be great. The reason doctors don't pursue those conversations, I think, is often they don't know what to say. So I thought I'd go through some of the strategies that we use for some of the commonest questions. Okay. And one of the very common ones that patients come up with quite quickly is, how long have I got, doctor? It's really important, they want to know. Now, people fudge it. They say, oh, well, you know, it's really hard to say. I wouldn't like to. Some are really awful and say, well, actually, it's about 6 months. We've had patients in the hospice with a calendar, and there is a ring round a date. And if they die before they get to the ring, that everybody feels cheated. But it's almost worse if they live past it, because they've done everything. And what then? You know, where do they go? So please never attach a number. Simply don't use numbers. You will be wrong. All the evidence says you will be wrong. The best way is to reflect it back. Well, clearly, you know that your life expectancy is limited. How do you feel? What's your idea? And do that early, because it might throw up a complete misconception. Well, 5 or 6 years, possibly 10. You know, it just gives you an idea where the patient is and how much work you've got to do to match expectation and reality. So reflect it back. Then talk about it in terms, again, of rate of change. How were you 3 or 4 months ago at Christmas? How were things then? How were you getting about? How did you feel? Oh, well, it wasn't too bad then. How quickly have you felt things change? Phrase it in terms of months, weeks, days. To relatives, I say, well, how quickly have they changed? Has it been month by month, week by week? Well, it's been week by week, doctor. Well, if that continues, their prognosis is likely to be of the order of weeks. And that way, you give them a useful tool to keep checking it out for themselves, because they'll realise that actually things have gone from week by week to day by day now. You get the occasional stroppy person who says, oh, what's the difference between week by week and day by day? You know, how many weeks and days and things. But on the whole, that works very well for people. We have a tendency as doctors to overestimate quite significantly. Doesn't that say something about us? We want what we're doing to succeed. The reality is we overestimate. We need to bear that in mind. The other thing that's very important is you will be less accurate if you know that patient very well. Again, what does that say about us? If it's somebody you've known for years, get somebody else to look, a fresh pair of eyes. We will be much less accurate if it's someone we know well. Yeah, that's what I've said. It's all evidence-based, this. Christakis has done a huge amount of work on this. In terms of accuracy, it's poor even within a week of death. Okay, so patients do take us by surprise. So you've had the conversation with the patient about the fact that their life is coming to an end. What do you do then? Well, one of the major drivers in end-of-life care nationally has been advanced care planning. There is a lot of misunderstanding around this. PCTs think that it's a simple form that you hand out, you get the patient to fill in, and that's it. And our PCT has insisted that 85% of patients who are considered end of life fill this form in, and then we give copies of them, completed, anonymised, to show the PCT that we've earned our sequin money. It's not a one-off piece of paper. It's a process. It will go on with several people participating. There may be a piece of paper involved that they can fill in, but it's not a one-off. It's basically a process of getting to the patient to think about their wishes and preferences about their dying. Where? Who? How would they like it to be? What about their funeral? It's not the same as an advanced decision to refuse treatment, which is a much more specific thing, which is legally binding, about how they decline particular medical treatments. It's much broader than that. The thing that it's useful to establish, if you can, is where they would like to be cared for, their preferred place of care, and where they would like to die. And often those are different, but bear in mind they also often change. as the situation moves on, they can change quite a lot. But that's basically what advanced care planning is, if you hear that phrase used. There is huge amounts of literature available around the whole thing about advanced care planning, both for professionals and for patients. This is one of them, produced by the National End of Life Care Programme, but there's an awful lot out there for you to access. Now, say we've moved a little bit closer to the patient dying. How do we care for a patient who is dying? The way I explain it to junior doctors is actually, it's not stopping care, it's changing gear, it's not caring less, actually it's caring more, but it's doing it very differently. Okay? And the key thing is to recognise that it's happening. An awful lot of medical students go through their whole training without ever witnessing a person die. Just like many adults go through their whole life, sometimes till their 60s now, with people, their relatives living longer, without actually ever seeing a dying patient, dying person. They don't know what it looks like. They've no norm to compare it against. And again, pattern, rate of change, symptoms, complications, but gradually somebody withdrawing, particularly socially, people withdraw, more time in bed, less communication, reduced oral intake, reduced consciousness. Think about oral intake that's been very pertinent in the debate around the Liverpool care pathway, the accusation that people have been starved and dehydrated to death. Actually, people who are genuinely dying stop eating and drinking. And they stop eating and drinking because they are dying, not the other way around. So that's a very important distinction to make and to explain to families that part of the body winding down is that you no longer wish or need to eat and drink in the same way. And actually, the Liverpool Care Pathway has a couple of very useful leaflets that go with it that explain the dying process very, very well to families. And again, they're on the internet. It's worth looking at those. So, patient's dying. What do you do? Well, I say patient goes to the top of the list for the simple reason that they do not have time to waste. If that patient wishes to go home, you cannot keep them in hospital an extra 48 hours if they've only got 72 hours to go. That's doctors indulging in wasting 66% of a patient's life expectancy. So this is urgent care. Review their treatment and the investigations. Make sure that chest x-ray that you ordered really just out of intellectual curiosity, or the blood tests again, that you were interested about but not essential, make sure they get cancelled. Think about symptom control needs. What needs to be written on the chart now in case this patient gets pain or breathlessness or agitation in the next 48 hours? Plan for emergencies. Is there anything that could go wrong? If there is, what are we going to do about it? Where do they want to die? And again, you have to be honest and open and ask the question explicitly. And it may be that a patient who said they were happy to stay in hospital suddenly changes their mind and wants to go home. It might be the other way around. Review them daily at least. It's very distressing to see still the ward rounds that just sail gently past the end of the bed and everybody looks at their feet a bit and nods seriously, but nobody engages with that person. Got to be reviewed daily, look at their chart daily, and at the appropriate moment, use the Liverpool care pathway, but use it properly. So that's the kind of care plan we're looking at. Now, I've put this here partly to remind you and partly to show you that the doses used in the Liverpool care pathway are very, very small. Okay, we are not talking about huge quantities. I go along with what John said. Talking about morphine in the context of double effect is a very bad example, because the doses that you would need to give somebody in order to reduce their respiratory rate and potentially hasten their death are huge. And we simply do not use doses like that. I think there's been work done at St. Christopher's to show that morphine doesn't hasten death when it's used appropriately at the end of life. It does relax people. It may mean that they go on for longer. Our hospital is one of the small group, though growing, that's taken part in every one of the last three national audits of the Liverpool Care Pathway. Places that do it properly sign up to the national audit. We've got lots of data to show that the doses used of diamorphine and midazolam in most dying patients who haven't been on morphine before, say, are actually very, very small. I haven't come across anybody where I've thought the LCP has hastened their demise through opioid abuse. We use very, very little. And I say to the doctors, even if you're not starting the whole Liverpool care pathway, at least write the drugs up so the nurses have something to use. In general practice, we have what are called just-in-case boxes. You come across those? Which is basically these drugs in a little plastic sandwich box with instructions and a prescription so that if the district nurse is called and needs to give some medication, hopefully it's there and they don't have to spend hours and hours finding an open pharmacy to prescribe things at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, the whole thing about palliative care is that it's holistic and that the family is part of the equation and that we take the psychological and spiritual aspects of care just as seriously as the physical ones. I would say, actually, you can't hope ever to do good psychological or spiritual work with a patient who has overwhelming symptoms. You simply can't. They're so taken up with the pain or the breathlessness, you have to get that right to really make progress in the other areas. So please do make sure you've got good symptom control going. But these are some of the challenges that are going on for families and for doctors as well around dying people. And I would say that all of these apply just as much to some of the doctors and nurses caring for dying people as for the patients themselves. Because doctors and nurses have often never thought about dying themselves. And their answer to the dying patient is just to keep treating and just to keep doing more and more and more of their thing, which may be completely inappropriate. It's a time of huge uncertainty, lots of fear going around, particularly fear about losing control, grief, the dying person realising what they're losing, saying goodbye to people themselves, very hopeless, lots of change, lots of important decisions to make increasingly. Family history and agendas, all kinds of things pop out of the woodwork in family histories. And the whole thing about information, who knows what, who's talking to who, is very important. This is another one of Dame Cicely's concepts, this idea of total pain. And sometimes pain is due to nerves and nociceptors. Sometimes it's because of emotional things, distress. Sometimes it is social. Don't ever underestimate the pain of a broken relationship. The worry about finances. We had a gentleman recently who became so much calmer when he realised that he'd finally managed to rehome his dog. It changed massively. It was so important for him that this dog was rehomed. And then the spiritual existential issues that people may never have thought of before that suddenly come up as they realise that actually the time's running out. And what I would say really is we need to start with psychological and social support well, well before the terminal phase. Sometimes it's just too late to leave it to the moment we start the Liverpool care pathway. Often those people are unconscious I'm sure the reason that the livable care pathway wasn't discussed with lots of patients is because they weren't conscious enough to have it discussed. It's meant for people in the last 72 hours. You know, the median time for people on the livable care pathway in the last national audit was 28 hours. A lot of them will not be able to discuss it. So you cannot leave this stuff till that end period. If you do, you've missed the boat. We need to keep focused on the patient. It's very easy to get sidetracked by other things, particularly relatives, and it involves teamwork. This is not something you can do on your own. It will mean other people in your team. People don't usually say important things to the person that they ought to say it to. So they won't have the spiritual conversation with the chaplain. They'll have it with you or with your junior. They won't own up about the thing that's really bothering them with the psychologist. They'll say it to the tea lady. So just be aware. Keep meeting together. Have multidisciplinary team meetings. And also, I think as Christians, we need to pray for opportunities that God will give us insights, that he will provide us with space and times when patients will open up and where we can have conversations with them about what's on their heart. I'm going to talk a little bit now about care, about the role of the relatives, because I have seen a significant change as a result of what's been going on in the press around the Liverpool care pathway. Now, that hasn't been people refusing to be on it. We've had nobody refuse. We've had a few more complaints. In retrospect, I saw this documentary and now I realise why my father died in the way he did. It was because of this horrible pathway. The biggest change has been that relatives now seem to think they have a far more significant role in medical decision making than the law gives them. They have got the right to decide what happens to their loved one. And actually they don't often. And this booklet, Treatment and Care Towards the End of Life, is very, very clear on it and clear on lots of other things. So I would recommend that to you, and I'll put up some of the most pertinent quotes on the slides. Very clear to understand that family confers no rights. We need to establish who the next of kin is. It is normally a relative, but it may not be. And even if you're the next of kin, you still have no legal authority unless you have a valid, applicable, lasting power of attorney. Okay? It's really important that you get the document in, you see what it says. It's no good for somebody to pitch up and say, oh, well, I've got power of attorney. No, legal document. Please, may I see it? I need to check that it's valid. I need to check that it applies. Family cannot demand treatments that doctors decide are not in the best interests of the patient or veto ones that doctors decide are in best interests. Now, the reason I bang on about this, if doctors get this wrong in a culture where euthanasia is illegal, imagine what will happen if euthanasia is legalised. We will have families deciding for their loved one what will happen. We must take a firm line on this and be absolutely clear that in a best interest decision, it is the doctors and the medical team that are responsible. We must not devolve that responsibility to family members. The other common problem is cultural issues, where certain cultures it is expected that the patient will not be told and or that the family make all the decisions. Big difference between Northern Europe, where it's all about autonomy, and parts of Southern Europe, where it's all about what the relatives say. And that's an issue for some doctors as well, who assume, because of their own culture, that it's the family that decide things. And the bottom line is, the family's choice does not override the doctor's in any best interest decision. Okay, but it's very easy to get it wrong. We've had family members called up to the hospital after midnight to decide what's going to happen about resuscitation, which is horrible for them. And then if they decide not to resuscitate and the patient dies, they have a whole load of guilt to carry around. Perhaps we decided the wrong thing. They should never, ever be asked that kind of thing. This is what the GMC says is the correct role of the family. We need to acknowledge their role. We need to be considerate and respectful and acknowledge that their views are important. We need to support them, but the focus of care must remain on the patient. Okay? We must not get sidetracked by families. It's very, very easy for a strong relative to take over. And when discussing issues with people who do not have legal authority, and that's most relatives, lasting powers of attorney are still vanishingly rare, it's their role to advise, okay? We must not give them the impression that they are being asked to make a decision. We are seeking their advice. And the key question is not, what would you like to happen? It's, what do you think your mother, your father would want in this situation? This is very pertinent to us when it comes to talking about elderly people going into nursing homes. You have a daughter, she's been caring for her elderly mother for years. She's exhausted. She wants her mother to go into a nursing home. You have to say, but what do you think your mother would like? Does she want to go home? Does she want the nursing home? Well, actually, if I'm honest, she really wants to go home again. We have to be clear about whose wishes we're talking about. And the same really applies to sharing information. Again, I think information is a very important commodity that belongs to the patient, and we share it only with their permission. And we only share it with the patient, with the people that they want to have it shared with. And again, that sometimes puts the juniors under huge pressure, and we need to support them in this and not bow to relatives who want to know an awful lot. Mustn't make assumptions about family relationships. There are terrible situations out there, I'm sure you're all aware, in general practice. And where, as Lord McCall said, where there is a will, there is a relative. You do get them popping up occasionally. So where possible, try and offer a record of a conversation and offer to repeat it later if need be, just to help the right people to understand. And really, just to sum up, if you're the doctor of a patient with 5 days left to live, what does the patient need from you? Well, yes, I've talked a lot about all the medical things, knowing the drugs, all that kind of thing. And yet, people do need a competent doctor. You need to get that patient symptom controlled. You need to find out what their wishes are and start trying to find openings into what's happening with them psychologically and spiritually. But they also need a compassionate human being. It's very much like John said earlier, it is about being a presence. And what I think is so sad about the way medicine is going is lots of juniors are not seeing that modelled on the wards. And they don't feel equipped to dare to do that. They're stuck in this medical model of, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, my job is to fix you. And they're too afraid to be human beings, and possibly because they've got all this stuff about dying in their own heads that they've never worked out. And the last thing is, I think we do need to pray for our patients. It doesn't need to be huge and lengthy, but I think it's tragic that thousands of people die in this country every year and no one has ever, ever raised their name in prayer before the Lord. That's dreadful, you know. And if we believe in prayer, even just lifting them to the Lord once, briefly, as you go in to see them. That difficult encounter that you're expecting, or as they leave your surgery, just raising their name to the Lord in prayer, I think would make a huge difference to this whole climate of fear and delusion that exists around death and dying. And also, it will perhaps set us on a course where we are more able to be a compassionate human being to people that need us to be that, rather than just a competent doctor. So I'll leave that with you. I'm happy to take questions later on.